What we have been doing is basically zodiology, which is the organization of the zodiac. And what we have been doing is kind of simple. It's very rudimentary and it's very introductory. We could spend much, much more time on everything we've done, and we could go into it deeply and be amazed by the way everything comes out. But that would be way too much. Basically, what we've been doing is exploring ideas. We've been trying to familiarize ourselves with basic ideas and a different way of thinking, a mystical way of thinking that allows us to deduce from universal ideas. This is the same way that everything is created in the cosmos. Everything comes from basic spiritual ideas that are put together in various ways and condensed into the world in various degrees, and that's the way things become. We've also been sharing information, but the purpose of these talks is not to share information. Because if you want information, you're in the wrong class. You should go to somebody who compiles information and piles you up with information, like putting a log on a freshly started fire and smothering it. We don't want to do anything like that. Now, what we've also been doing is not really astrology. Because astrology, real astrology, is tedious and it's technical. But if you get the idea of this, the idea of deducing and the idea of intuiting, regular astrology will come easily. All you have to do is put this onto the technical stuff. Unfortunately, most people work with the technical stuff and they don't ever work with the intuition, and they don't have these kinds of ideas to work with, and that's kind of sad. There are classes that follow this class, but they are immediately in the technical realm. There is a class that follows this that lasts about 3 years, and I would be very happy to do that if there are 7 people who will commit themselves to 3 years of working. But otherwise, I'm just not going to do it. You contact Julie, she wants to do it, and she's willing to do all the organizing to see that people get into line, and she's one of those Aries that cracks a whip so that if you say you're going to come, you better come, because... as far as these ideas are concerned, they're not the only ones, and they're not the only ways of getting at them. And if you're really living creative lives, you're going to find your own things about the signs of the zodiac. And hopefully when you do, I hope you come back excited and tell me what you have discovered and the way you see it, because that would be the greatest reward that I could get. It would show me that I was helpful in helping people to understand how to get to the basic principles of everything. So we've looked at zodiology, and we've looked a little bit at domology, but that would be much more in the next course. Now what we're going to do is we're going to look at some very simple ways to understand the zodiac in a different way. And they're as close as I get to a party game. And I'm not ashamed of it, because it can't be ponderous all the time. It has to be something that is effective. And so what we're going to do is called the point of view game. It's based on dodecal geometry. And in close-packed structures, the most points that you can put around any given point, if all points are the same size, and if they're infinitely small, they are all the same size, the most that you can put around any point are 12 around the 13th. And that means that for any point in three-dimensional space, there are 12 distinct points of view. And each of those distinct points of view is important. And by seeing them in relation to each other, you get to understand the whole, and you get to see each one of the points of view better. Yes? It's the geometry of a dodecahedron. It's 12 around the 13th, and it's actually 12 equilateral pentagons that fit around a center. And it's used a lot in close-packed structures because it's trying to find the ultimate foundation of crystallization in space. Close-packed structures. All right. Now, the time has come to speak about profound things like popcorn. There was a time that I was a radical and dedicated popcorn person. You know, popcorn people, they can fight hours about whether the white popcorn is better than the yellow. And it used to be, before they allowed it to degenerate, it was a hands-down thing that Redenbacher's was without a doubt the best popcorn. But since it's been taken over by a brand label, it's been downgraded significantly. Now, I used to have a friend, a very dear friend named Charlie. And Charlie was an ingenious kind of guy. And he had strange notions would come into his mind. For example, he was gluing something one day, and a drop of glue fell on his shoes. And he said, "Wow, that looks shiny. If I paint my whole shoes with glue, I'll have a permanent shoe shine." And so Charlie painted his shoes with glue, and they were stiff, and he got them in, and he took two steps, and they looked like alligator shoes. But that was Charlie. I've lost touch with him, and I've tried time and time again to get in touch with him, and I could never find him. I remember that when I first got the little building for the little bookstore, we were all remodeling it together. We were walking down the street, and I was in a hurry. I was walking ahead, and Charlie and another friend were walking behind. And Charlie said to the other friend, he said, "Do you know, my real self and your real self might be talking to each other right now, and neither of us know about it." And that sort of thing is true, but that was the way Charlie thought about the universe. But one time, in a casual conversation with several of us, Charlie dropped the fact that he knew how to make softer popcorn than anyone else. And of course, this was a group of people that were all popcorn people. And the challenge that somebody could make softer popcorn set up a very vigorous discussion that was never resolved. And Charlie was a very soft-hearted Cancer. And that's probably why he saw things in terms of soft popcorn. But at any rate, it set off a whole bunch of thinking and a whole bunch of observation that led to the point of view game. And the point of view game is based on the same principle that we have 12 people in a jury, that each of the 12 points of view gives an essential, they don't select juries by signs of the zodiac anymore, but they wouldn't be that off if they did. So the first thing in the point of view game is, what is the secret of popcorn preparation? For Aries, the secret is the temperature. You have to have the temperature right. For Taurus, it's the starch quality. If the texture of the starch isn't right, the popcorn isn't going to work right. And obviously, for Gemini, the secret of popcorn making is the vibration. Everything has to be vibrating, and if it isn't, the popcorn isn't going to pop right. For Cancer, the secret of making good popcorn is the moisture. These are the people that keep the popcorn in the refrigerator because the moisture content can be held that way. Leo thinks it's the general heat consistency, that if you have the same amount of heat in the same area, that will produce the best popcorn. Virgo, of course, believes that you have to have organic popcorn in order to make in order to make good popcorn. But Libra thinks that the secret of good popcorn making is in the oil. Sagittarius thinks that it is the size of the kernel. Unless you have big unless you have big kernels, you're not going to have good popcorn. Oh, Scorpio doesn't reveal its secrets. Capricorn thinks that it's in the skin, that the skin has to have the right texture. And obviously, Aquarius thinks that the secret of good popcorn making is in electronic devices. If you have an electronic popcorn maker, you can control all of those things like temperature and heat and everything else. Pisces doesn't think that way at all. Pisces thinks that the secret of good popcorn making is that you have to pray to the nature spirits. And the nature spirits bring the popping about in the best way possible. All right. How about the quality of popcorn? Why is the quality of popcorn improved one way or another? Aries thinks it's because you can get out there and physically shake it. Taurus thinks it's good because of density. Gemini thinks it's because of the air. And of course, Cancer thinks that the way you get the best popcorn is through genetics. It's big on the genetic things. Leo thinks you get good popcorn by commanding both the popcorn and the popper to do it right. You know, not that there's any power craziness here or anything like that. Virgo thinks that you get the good popcorn by practice. You keep practicing and practicing, and eventually you make better popcorn. And obviously, Libra thinks that if you want to have good popcorn, you have to love it. Because if you don't love the popcorn, you won't get good popcorn. Scorpio thinks that it is the germinal quality. It is the creativity that is at the heart of the kernel that produces good popcorn. Sagittarius thinks it's because of the levity. Just think of that light popcorn, you know, it just sort of floats in the air almost. This one, the secret of good popcorn, I'm indebted to Mark for this one, because it is good judgment. Mark knows other popcorn people, and they make popcorn like in a frying pan or in a kettle that you put a cover on. And part of the good judgment is to get exactly the right amount of popcorn for the container. And there's only one way you can know that, and that is if you get a one. And Capricorn always likes number one. And that is when you put the popcorn in and everything pops, you know you had the optimal amount when just the cover lifts up and just one kernel falls out. If it's two, you overshot. And if none, you don't know how far under you were. So the only way you can tell is with a one. And that kind of judgment is a very Capricorn kind of thing. And of course, Aquarius thinks that the secret of good popcorn is that you buy imported popcorn. The stuff that comes from America, it isn't right anymore. The soil has been played out. And of course, Pisces thinks that you get good popcorn by going to the store and taking your pendulum. And you go and you put it over all of the popcorn. All right. Why is making popcorn so much fun? For Aries, it's the challenge. It's challenging to see if you can make the best fun. For Taurus, it's the standard. eating. Well, why make popcorn if the main purpose isn't for eating? For Gemini, it's a good chance to get together with other people and talk. You can even talk with popcorn in your mouth if you're clever about it. And for Cancer, the real joy of doing popcorn is you can get together intimately with each other. And there's a closeness, you know, like we're all one big popcorn family. For Leo, it's the whole idea of the celebration. We can be happy and we can have a great time. And for Virgo, it's a chance to develop a method. It's a chance that we can have this program so that we can get together and everything will be just right. Of course, for Libra, it's sharing. The more we share, the better it is. And Scorpio loves to get together to make popcorn because the popcorn self-destructs. Yeah. Sagittarius likes it because it's sort of like a sport. And Capricorn likes it because it's a tradition. And everybody sits around the table or around the living room in the same place. And of course, it is all determined who sits where. There's that order of things. Aquarius likes the whole business of popcorn making because it isn't organized. The pops happen randomly, and that's really what Aquarius likes. And Pisces likes popcorn making because it can feel left out and cry about it. Yeah, these are a little bit hard on the Pisces, I must say. What is the best way to eat popcorn? For Aries, peppered, and it better be red pepper too. For Taurus, you eat it on bread with a topping of pancakes and a side dish of spaghetti and a second side dish of rice. For Gemini, many ways. You can't eat popcorn just one way. You've got to eat it a different way every time. Popcorn is the variety of life. You know, it can't be the same way. For Cancer, salted. It has to be salted. For Leo, they want to eat popcorn with royal jelly on it. Royal jelly is the stuff they get from the bees, from the queen bee. Virgo, and this is honest to God truth, Virgo likes to eat popcorn with nutritional yeast on it. And if they make it without oil, which is a really healthy way to make it, you have to have some way for the yeast to stick. So what you do is you mix sprouts, alfalfa sprouts in the popcorn and then put yeast. I actually used to eat popcorn that way. Sprouts and nutritional yeast, yes. Of course, Libra thinks that the best way to eat popcorn is candied, especially if it's those colored candy popcorn balls that you see that are weeks old. For Scorpio, the best way to eat popcorn is with vinegar. There's no other way about it. For Sagittarius, the best way to eat popcorn is with butter and lard and coconut oil if you can get it. For Capricorn, the best way to eat popcorn is aged and with minerals on it. For Aquarius, it's with spices and with herbs. And for Pisces, obviously, the best way to eat popcorn is marinated in wine. All right, now you get the idea. I have several others here, and you find that they get very close to keywords or key ideas, and it's a wonderful mental exercise. I've done it several times in life. I at one time just took one keyword for one sign of the zodiac and looked at it from many different points away, developing philosophical ideas all together. In fact, I have a series of talks on transitions into the Aquarian Age. And I did it that very way. Principles that are in society right now and see how they lead to the consciousness that we're going to have in the Aquarian Age. Yes. Yeah, we're going to be talking about that in a little bit. That's the other little thing for tonight. Now, in Christianity, Orthodox Christianity, the spiritual life that you develop is called the Way. And if you want to know yourself and your spiritual progress the most clearly of all, you find how really whether you love Christ by the way you drive on the highway. And so each of the signs of the zodiac has its own way of driving on the highway. Like, for example, Aries drives offensively. It's preemptive. You get the first strike in before they can get you. You drive aggressively. Taurus, you drive consistently. You drive steadily. You never change lanes if your life depends on it. You always stay the same. We have a trip that about four or five of us take every year. And there's one Gemini. He's a triple Gemini. Sun, Moon, and Ascendant in Gemini. And all the rest of us mostly are fixed signs. And he can't stand it when the others are driving because we almost never change lanes being fixed signs. And he's in there weaving all over the place. It's quite something. So for Gemini, the whole idea is you change a lot. For Cancer, obviously, it's defensive driving, as defensive as you can be. Leo drives masterfully. I'm the lion of the highway, and everybody else better get out of the way. There was a time that I used to go down Blood Alley. I used to drive, I lived in Oceanside, California, and I had a girlfriend that lived on the the Bay Area, the South Bay Area in Los Angeles. And this is when Highway 101, or Highway 1, went from San Diego to Los Angeles, and it was a three-lane death trap, you know, where the middle lane was shared by both directions. And I would go from Oceanside to the Santa Monica Freeway, bull of the road, meaning to say nobody passed me unless I passed them back. And because for me, I had Neptune conjoined the Ascendant, so I became a sort of a psychic driver. I would look down the field of cars. I wasn't driving my old cars. That didn't make any difference. And I could tell who was going to change lanes what way. You just got a sense. But then I became really Scorpio or Leo-like. I thought, well, why have to guess where they're going to change lanes, even if you have a good sensitive intuition, when you can get them to change lanes as you wish? All it takes is a little bit of psychic incentive to get them to move to that other lane. Virgo drives methodically. Virgos are the type that put markings on their tachometer, and they shift exactly when the needle gets to that marking because that's the optimal. Of course, Libra drives considerately. They always have the other person in mind, whereas Scorpio is a vengeful driver. You do that to me, I'm going to cut you off. Sagittarius drives carelessly. It's all over the place. And Capricorn is really careful, really careful, slowly. And Aquarius drives pretty erratically, but sometimes intuitively. And Pisces, of course, drives under the influence. Now, I have a friend that was a sun in Libra libertarian, meaning to say that he wanted his freedom. And so when he drove across town, he would drive across town in such a way that he went through the least amount of arterial stops. And if there had to be stops, he took boulevard stops. An arterial stop is the one with the light, and a boulevard is a sign. Because he said, you don't have any choice with the light, but you have freedom of when you're going to go with the stop sign. And so the way you select the route is also a way that you can come to an understanding of the signs of the zodiac. For Aries, it is where you can compete the most, and you take the most exciting route. For Taurus, you choose according to the quality of the road. You know, you don't want to go down anywhere where there are potholes. For Gemini, you choose a route that has the most alternatives, so that if something's going wrong here, you can take that route and, you know, they can branch and go this way or that. For Cancer, you take the route that goes past the most open and visible water. I've done that. I've even gone across town. I've tried all of these things out in crazy ways. I've gone across town seeing how I could go past the most parks, for example. Leo chooses the route where it could show off the most. Virgo chooses the route by intensive map study. And Libra, of course, chooses the most scenic route. Either that or it says, why don't you choose? Scorpio chooses the one that is most psychological, especially if it has a secret quality that's unexpected about it. Sagittarius wants the route with the greatest amount of ease. Capricorn is like I used to ride my motorcycle. I would take the route to work that I knew every inch of that route. It was a history matter. And you know where people were likely to do terrible things and where there were likely to be bottlenecks and things like that. Aquarius is just the opposite. It wants the route with the most novelty. And of course, if you have a GPS system, that's all the better. And Pisces takes the route that it's easiest to get lost by. History, so that you know every detail from the history, what has happened in previous instances at this intersection. You know, there are some places where people are more prone to go on yellow than in others. And if you look, if you take a route again and again, you see that. And I've had my life saved several times by not going out, even when I was legally in the right to go out. All right. Now, if you want to study rising signs, you can look at the features of animals in rising signs, but I think is better is to take expressions. And by looking at the different rising signs, you can get the expressions on the face. For example, Aries rising often very often has a cocky expression on its face. And Taurus rising always is chewing. Whether it has gum or not, it's chewing. And with Gemini rising, I don't know how to describe it, but you'll notice that after a while, there's always a tricky little grin. And Cancer is always shy. It has a hard time often looking you in the face. And then we have the classical one from Leonardo da Vinci. For Leo, he shows that a sneer on the face is the same in a big cat, like a lion or something like that, but I think he uses something like a jaguar or a panther, as it is in a human. Virgo has a studious look on its face. And of course, Libra likes to pout and be flirtatious. And Scorpio rising, you can always tell because of the leering quality. Sagittarius rising is always laughing. Or Capricorn rising is quite serious, often frowning. A Capricorn rising has the very best poker face. And Aquarius rising very often has the wide-eyed fanatical stare about it. And of course, Pisces, the expression is usually crying. So we've looked at some of these. We'll go really quickly through a couple more just so you can get the idea of what the different kinds of things you can do. For example, a life philosophy. This is more for the sun sign, but sometimes it works for the rising sign. Competition. I worked for high energy physicists, and there were a lot of Aries in the lot when I was there, and they were highly competitive with each other. For Taurus, materialism. Either materialism meaning everything comes out of matter, or materialism meaning the more matter you have, the more successful you are. We mentioned Gemini already as being phenomenalistic. Cancer likes subjectivism. Leo likes imperialism. Virgo likes perfectionism. Not perfecting, but perfectionism. It's also a sign of nominalism. The philosophy of Libra is other orientation. The philosophy of Scorpio is reductionism. For Sagittarius, it's idealism. Capricorn, it is a philosophy of precedent, or a philosophy of hierarchy. Obviously, the clearest one for Aquarius is some kind of evolutionary philosophy, that it's always evolving into something new. And for Pisces, it's a philosophy of relativism, or even a philosophy of disorganization. It's easier to find things. I have a few more things here, but I think I'll pass on that. That's enough of that, because it's a wonderful thing to do, but it can get tiresome. And it's very hard to do if you take basic ideas, one basic idea from a keyword of each sign of the zodiac, and then run that same idea through all of the other signs. It's a wonderful exercise, but if you keep adding second or third ideas onto the first one, it becomes an enormously hard exercise. In the first place, you have to have a huge vocabulary, and in the second place, you have to be able to conceptualize without losing the basic thing you're trying to get at, to conceptualize that in a different kind of metamorphosis. And that's a really, really important thing. Hard to do. All right. Let's turn to something that is not quite so light, but it's a different way of looking at the zodiac. Since astrology is all about things that come to place in time, what we are talking about is history. Now, there are numerous ways that you can study history astrologically. You can look at individual events and the times that they occur under. That's most commonly done, but it happens to be the most terrible way. Probably a better way is to look at astrological cycles or patterns. And all of the ways that you can study astrology are valid, and they all prove fruitful. And it really increases your understanding of what's really going on in history and how the astrology works. But it's hard work. It takes a lot of time, because the astrological influences are extremely subtle. Most people don't even notice the difference of one month to another. So even a lot of things require interpretation. Like, it took me years to understand one event, and I couldn't understand it in terms of the event alone. And that event was that on the same day, at the same hour, the two worst fires in American history occurred at the same meridian of longitude. One was the Peshtigo Forest Fire in northern Wisconsin, where people boiled in the rivers like soup because they jumped in the river to save their lives. And the other was the Chicago Fire. They happened on the same day, same hour, same meridian of longitude. And the hour is known, and you can cast a horoscope on it, and you can look at it, and look at it, and look at it, and you wouldn't find anything. But if you study it in terms of cycles, it is the first that that event happened, the first time that the moon passed over Uranus after Uranus had been in Leo for the first time in 90-some years, and Leo was big fires. There were other cyclical indicators. But unless you knew about the triggering effect of the moon and Leo ruling big fire and such, you wouldn't have gotten that. And you'd look at the chart, and it didn't look like anything meaningful. And so it's not an easy thing to do, but I think it's really worthwhile. We're going to look at one zodiacal cycle very briefly this evening. And at another time, look at some other things. Now, there are different kinds of zodiacs. Like the Aztec zodiac had many more partitions than just 12. And the lunar zodiac, especially in India, has 28 divisions to it. They're called nakshatra. And so there are all kinds of different zodiacs. Even in the zodiacs used in the Western world, there have been of various lengths. At one time, there used to be a 10-sign zodiac, and everything that now covers from Virgo all the way through Scorpio used to be one sign, one great big long sign. But even in our 12-sign zodiac, there are different zodiacs. The zodiac that we have been using is called the tropical zodiac. And it is sometimes called the intellectual zodiac. Now, this is something I'm going to repeat several times and emphasize very strongly. The zodiac that we are using, you cannot see when you look up in the heavens. You cannot see the intellectual zodiac when you look into the heavens with your eyes. You can see constellations, but that is not the zodiac we use. So we have to look at some things. Oh boy, I should have got out some globes and things like that. Well, we'll draw some pictures. They may not be very good. The Earth undergoes several motions. First of all, it rotates on its axis, which is called axial rotation. And one rotation takes 24 hours, 24 sidereal hours, even though we say it with 25 solar hours. And the Earth itself goes the same direction around the Sun. It must, because of the way the solar system was produced. And this is called orbital revolution. So the Earth is goes around the Sun once a year. And so it makes one orbital revolution every year. But the Earth is not straight up and down. If you look at the solar system, it's a big ball of fire. And for the most part, it's a plane, and that plane is called the ecliptic. And with the exception of Pluto and Mercury, most of the planets stay within that plane all the time. But when they're in that plane, they're not upright. The Earth, if this is the equator, is inclined to the ecliptic by 23 degrees, 21 minutes, and 23 seconds. I believe that's the way it is. Maybe it's 21, 23, 21. No, I believe it is. I got it wrong. Let's just say 21 degrees. So that when, if the Earth is inclined like this, if this is the equator, when it's here, the Sun is more directly in the southern hemisphere, if this is the North Pole. When it's over here, the Sun strikes more in the northern hemisphere, and this is winter for us. When it's over here, and the sun strikes exactly on the equator, that is spring. That's all pretty obvious. Everybody, we all learned this pretty much in grade school. And over here would be the autumnal equinox. Now those are the movements of the Earth, and this is why the sun is higher at one time of the year than it is at another time of the year. It is because the Earth is always inclined. Not only that, the moon, the orbit of the moon, is inclined by another 7 degrees to the equator. So that at sometimes the moon goes much farther north, and then sometimes it doesn't get very far north at all, even at its northmost part. That's a 19-year cycle. So there are all kinds of variations just between the sun and the moon. Now, what we want to talk about is the relationship of the moon to the Earth. Now, the Earth, let's draw an Earth here. Because it is semi-fluid, it is not a sphere. It is called a lumpy problate ellipsoid, meaning to say that it's spinning, and because it's semi-fluid in the inside, it gets flattened at the poles, and it bulges at the equator. So it's sort of shaped like that instead. That's a pretty extreme statement of it, but it's obvious that way. Now, this wouldn't make any difference about things if the moon went around the Earth right at the equator, but it doesn't. But because the inclination of the moon's orbit is 7 degrees, approximately, that means that at different times, its gravitational effect on this bulge of the equator is greater than at other times. And the fact of the matter is that when the moon is in its part of the orbit, that it's approaching the part of the orbit where it's right on the equator, its gravitation is stronger, and it pulls the Earth toward itself. It pulls the bulge toward itself. So as it's coming upward toward the equator, it causes the Earth to tip just a very little bit. But when it gets past, it tips back again, but the difference has been made. And then when it comes back down the other side, it causes it to tip again the same direction. And this is a fairly constant motion. The tipping effect causes the Earth, if you think about it, it's like if you go swimming up north where there are still lumbering logs in the water. You can push a big, heavy log with your finger. And even though the Earth is many, many tons, it's floating in space. And these little things make a difference, so that twice a month the Earth is being tilted like that. And when it's tilted like that, it is, we've talked about this before, if there is a vector of energy, there is a field or a pull at right angles. And so according to torque mechanics, as the, I got this arrow the wrong direction. So gradually, these little twists like that cause a vector of energy going out the other direction. And that causes the Earth to wobble. And the wobble is very, very slow. It doesn't wobble like a top, because a top has one of the poles is stationary. In this case, both poles are wobbling. The wobble is so slow that one complete wobble
is 25,868 years.
And because it wobbles, when it is spring here, it wobbles the opposite direction that it goes around the sun, and the opposite direction that it rotates on its axis. It's actually pulling out this way. And so that when it goes opposite, when the Earth goes all the way around the sun, because it has been pulled this way, instead of happening right here, the equinox happens a very tiny amount earlier. It precedes, and that's called the precession of the equinox. And so each year, or over many, many years, at exactly the first day of spring, when the sun is exactly on the equator, or appears to be on the equator, there is a different background of stars. And because it takes 25,868 years, that means every 72 years, it is a day difference. So that if this star is on the equinox, behind the sun at the equinox, 72 years later, the sun will get to that star a day later, because equinox is the zodiac. All right, you got the idea. This means that gradually the equinoctial point, which is sort of like the ascendant of the Earth, goes backwards through the constellations. And the constellations are what most people think the signs of the zodiac are. Now the reality is that there is one kind of influence that comes from the tropical zodiac. We see that all the time. You plant your seeds when the sun is in Taurus. You don't plant your seeds in tropical Taurus. You don't plant it when it's in sidereal Taurus, because that's one part of the cycle. You'll be planting your seeds in midwinter or in fall. So there is a local influence from the tropical zodiac, and there is a long-term sidereal influence from the sidereal zodiac. But there is an analogy between them, or there's the relationship of them to each other is analogous. I'm probably lost from my notes here, but so let's make a list of the types of zodiacs. I'll put it over there, but then they wouldn't see it on the camera. I don't think so. Oh yeah, I may have that. Yeah, I may have it backwards. Yeah. Listen to my words, not my drawings. All right. We have the tropical zodiac, which is sometimes called the intellectual zodiac. And sometimes it's called the sign zodiac. This is what we have been using. The ones that are the star patterns, but the star patterns broken up into equal sizes, because actually some of the constellations are much bigger than the others, and some are real small. That's called the sidereal zodiac. And sometimes it is called the natural zodiac. And sometimes it's called the constellational zodiac, which is a bad thing to call it, because there is a constellational zodiac which means something a little bit different. So this is the zodiac we're using. There are sidereal forms of astrology. Like most astrology from India is one kind of sidereal astrology or another. And there are other kinds of siderealism that are completely different altogether. And so each of these zodiacs has an effect. You can learn sidereal astrology and you can do very well, but you cannot treat sidereal astrology the same way that you treat tropical astrology, because you know, you don't use the rules of basketball in a football game. There are conventions, and the whole tempo of the way the game goes depends on how those conventions and rules are set up. So there are two zodiacs, and remember that what we're doing is the tropical zodiac. But the relationship between the tropical zodiac and the sidereal zodiac has a lot to do with history. Now, where in the sidereal zodiac the first degree of Aries is a very controversial thing. People have spilled tubs full of ink writing articles on why they think it begins at this spot or at this spot or at this spot. I'm not going to go into it now because I could give you justification why I have used the numbers that I have here. But some of them are as much as 500 years apart from each other for where the given sidereal signs begin. See, because there isn't anything in the heavens, you know, there isn't like a blinking light saying, here's where the cycle begins and here's where it ends. The numbers that I'm using here say that the end of the age of Aries and the beginning of the age of Pisces, which would be right at the very beginning of the zodiac, was at 498 AD. That is used by students of the mystery schools. This is what was used by Madame Blavatsky. This is what is used by Max Heindel and Rudolf Steiner. Also, people who used to study what you could call the angelologies, like Tycho de Brahe, used this as the starting point. And, you know, different schools have different reasons, and I want you to know that what you're being taught here isn't the only way. There are other ways that you can look at it. The reason that the mystery schools seem to pan out right is because right at about this time in 490s was the Second Council of Nicaea. And the Second Council of Nicaea took everything that was in the ancient world, all of the wisdom of the ancient world, the Greeks and the people that came before them, all of it was declared heresy. From the 490s on, it was called being plunged into the Dark Ages. And it was a time when people lived in by faith, and they lived in superstition, and they had sort of a Pisces carelessness. It's what Bertrand Russell says, people thought that you were holier if you smelled more, and that there was a direct relationship between how little you bathed and how greatly spiritual you were. And that sounds like the laziness of the Pisces era. Everything gets backwards. All right, but you get at what we're trying to say here, that there are successive ages of history, and that each of these ages of history has qualities that are distinct to that quality, and distinct in that quality, and they relate to the very things that we have been talking about astrologically. Let's talk about some of those. At this point right here, at approximately 8200 BC, was what was called the last deluge of Atlantis. This is the one that Plato was taught about. And what it was some sinking of some islands in the Atlantic, and Atlantis was something much different. I don't want to say much more about that, but I want to talk about what the attitudes were. We have no historical records of this. But in the age of Taurus, everything was earth-oriented. In the age of Aries, everything was conquering-oriented. In the age of Pisces, everything was exploration-oriented. And now, with the age of Aquarius, everything is becoming very scientific in its orientation, just like that, like we talked about Aquarius before. Now let's take a look at the symbols and the symbols that were present in the religions at that time. The oldest records that we have belong to the Egyptians. And for the Egyptians, the symbol was the scarab. And the scarab is a beetle. And so historically, at the time that scarabs appear, coincides with the time that the equinoctial point, the first day of spring, was passing through the constellation or the constellational area of Cancer. Similarly, when the equinoctial point got to Gemini, the symbols of spirituality of the priesthood, which was also the royalty, were lizards. Like the king or the queen, the divine king or queen was pictured in a cart drawn by lizards, which is exactly what we've been finding with Gemini. During the period when from 3700 BC to 1600 BC was the age of Taurus. And that was when the bull was the symbol. All over the world, it was the symbol. It was Apis, or it was, I can't remember all of them. What's the, I forget them all. Brahmism in India. Your wealth was determined by how many bulls you owned, and the priesthood, the sacred priesthood, was associated with the bulls. Then, somewhere in here, when the equinoctial point got to Aries, you rubbed lamb's blood over the lintel of the door, and you did it right at the Passover. That is when the sun passed over the equator. So the symbol, religious symbol, moved from the sign of the bull to the sign of the ram. And then it moved to the sign of Pisces, the sign of fishes and loaves. And now we're approaching a time when the symbol of spirituality or the religion of the day is becoming more and more humanistic. It's becoming very much like Aquarius. And so that the timings in what you find in historical symbols associated with religion and the way people did things coincide together with the constellations through which the equinoctial point was going. It's a very fascinating kind of thing. Let's see, I'm very forgetful tonight. There are a lot of things that I wanted to say along the line there that I didn't hold them right behind the thought I was saying. Oh, difficulties. Backwards. Yeah, I just told you, that's because of that precession, because the wobble causes the first day of spring to happen a little earlier. And so it goes backwards through the stars of the entire zodiac. In fact, when it goes over fixed stars, given fixed stars, like right at this time, 498 AD, if you look at the that this is sort of what the constellation of Aries looks like. In fact, this horn of Aries sort of sticks out like this, and the north fish actually overlaps Aries. And at Aries Gamma, right before the division between, is the time when Jesus was here. Because the name for Jesus is the same as the name for Jesher or Joshua. Remember, Joshua fought the Battle of Jericho and he blew on a ram's horn and you entered into the promised land. You entered into a whole new kingdom. And this is a name that goes back thousands of years, and it's just coincidental that the equinoctial point passes right over that star at the time that Jesus is there. Some people thought that was the beginning of Aries, but you know, we will allow them their superstitions. All right. But you get the idea now? All right. Suppose, All right, suppose I'm walking along, and I'm circling around everybody in the room here. Yeah, and if I go at a constant speed, always at the same time, I will get to the same person. But if I'm leaning back a little bit, at the same time I'm going forward, you know, like if this arm is sticking out, and I go around the entire zodiac, and this arm comes to David, it'll come there at the same time every year. But if the earth is wobbling, and the arm gets thrown over a little bit, I'll go all the way around, and it'll point at David a little bit earlier. And so gradually, the star that is behind David, as you go around again and again, the point that is behind David, well, David's the son at this point. He looks like the sun king. Will gradually shift around the entire zodiac, and eventually it'll get so that I'll be over here when I'm exactly pointing at David. All right, it's not a very good picture, but I've got some apparatus up in the attic, but I actually have a whole little planetarium kind of thing that shows the whole procession and such. But even with that, people don't get it sometimes. You'll just have to rely on your pictorial qualities, your imaginative abilities. All right, you get the whole idea of what we're talking about. Now, there is a natural evolution of religion. Like in times when the equinox is proceeding through Cancer, the way one gets experience is through sensitivity. Remember, Cancer is the feeler. When it comes to Gemini in precessional cycles, the whole idea is remembering and making connections between different sensations. And when you get the Taurus, there is incentive to remember, because whoever has the best memory gets the most rewards. And so it becomes a religion of, you know, like in the Bible, you do this right and you get so many sheep or something like that. And you find that in all the religious books during the Taurus epoch. And then the philosophy changes away from not reward and acquisition. It gets to a quality of daring. You know, like you have champions when the religion is in the age of Aries. And where we saw divine blind faith and devotion in the age of Pisces. So religion evolves, and along with the religious symbols, and the character of what is considered religious goes along with the character of the constellation through which the equinoctial point is passing. All right. Devotion, yes. Blind faith. Remember when we said that, well, we'll get to, I got a few more things. In the age of Taurus, everything was based in rigid castes. In the age of Aries, when the Greeks and Persians were really strong, it was based more on individualism. Castes still existed, but there was more individualism. In the age of Pisces, everything, the value of society, was based on divine centering, the relationship to God, not according to a caste or not according to any individualism or anything of that nature. Now, this opposite sign, you know, like, it has the quality of the esotericism. I don't know how to say it. The sign through which the equinox is passing, the constellation through which it is passing, represents the macrocosmic religion, the exoteric religion for the masses. That is the bull or the ram or the fishes and loaves, because the loaves are the opposite sign, Virgo. But the esoteric is with the opposite sign of the zodiac. So like if you go here and you look at it in history, you can look at it in India, when the general religion was the religion of Gemini, the esoteric religion was the opposite side, and that was the horse cults. Some of the horse cults even persisted into early Greece, but they were certainly all over in India at the time that the Rig Veda was coming down and things like that. When the equinox was proceeding through Taurus, Scorpio was the opposite sign. And so you had the Ophites, and you had the Nagas in India, and the esoteric signs were associated with Scorpio. So even that Heracles, when he had his ears licked clean by the serpents, he could then hear the animals speak with each other, and that was a symbol. And that some of that still persisted until the times of Christ, because Christ says, "Be ye wise as serpents, but gentle as doves." And he was relating to that, the serpent being Scorpio and the dove being Taurus, just as we have said. Then the opposite sign of Aries is Libra. And during this period is when the esoteric students studied the law. And to this day yet, when you get your degree, you get it on sheepskin. But it was the law and the prophets during the time when the equinox was proceeding through Aries. In Pisces, the quality was blind devotion and everything else, but the opposite sign, the esoteric sign, Virgo, alchemists. And it was the clerics, people who were the literary people. And when they began to tendency toward literalism, that spread across to everyone. In Aquarius, it's a kind of humanism, and it has to do with the development of the etheric body for the masses, but the control of the etheric body comes through the heart, the opposite sign, meaning to say that when you do something from the goodness of your heart, you develop the heart as a voluntary muscle. And soon you are able to direct or control the heart like a completely voluntary organ. And that's part of the esotericism that's coming up in the Age of Aquarius. But by the way, this says that the Age of Aquarius does not begin until 2653. We've been feeling the influence since the middle of the 19th century, just like you see the influence of the dawn coming before the sun gets to the equator. You know what I mean? There's light there. And, yeah. No, it doesn't. Things fade into each other. Everything in history and everything in cycles, because they're more like the spiritual worlds. In this world, you're talking about in an individual horoscope. That's different than in a historical cycle. Yes. Yes, in individual horoscopes, if you're in 28 degrees of a sign, you're somewhat anticipating the next sign. Yes. Especially because most of your childhood development years, which are so important, are going to be in the next sign, not the sign that you were born in. And so the atmosphere that you were born in is going to shift to another atmosphere, and that's the one that you develop in, and that's going to have a lot to do with your formation. So we're saying that the Aquarian age, when the sun is right exactly on the sun, so to speak, in the sunrise, is 2653. So we've got a long ways to go yet. Now, in the horoscope, Aries represents the beginning of the zodiacal year. But in the natal horoscope, the ascendant represents birth, and it represents the physical body. So the physical body of society is architecture. So if we look at the architecture for each of these periods, it's very, very clear that this all holds true. If you look, for example, in the Age of Taurus, you have big, massive walls and citadels of walls inside of walls in the Age of Taurus. when you get to the age of Aries, it becomes like Greek architecture, bold and open. When you get to the age of Pisces, then you have the cathedrals. And what do the cathedrals have? They have all these ugly gargoyles, and everything is dark and misty and everything like that. And so that, what did we say when we were talking about Pisces? It takes ugliness and carries it so far that it sees beauty in ugliness, or that something is so ugly it's beautiful. And that's the Pisces quality. If you look at, as we approach the Aquarian age, we said that Aquarius has two rulers, the lower ruler being Saturn and the higher being Uranus. Saturn rules concrete. The architecture now is concrete. Uranus rules glass, so we're seeing all of these glass and concrete structures. That's the whole quality of it. So each of these things, and what is interesting, you know, I'm surprised that the historians don't do a lot with this, is that there is a coincidence between the trends in architecture or the trends in religion or the trends in symbology that coincides exactly with session of the equinox. Now, some historians do study this, and they say, well, everybody had a common superstition, and that's why things happened that way, and it isn't because, you know, as if they knew all of these things with the people of the common superstition. Aries, or the first house, is the hero. And so the heroes change from age to age. In Taurus, the richest man in Babylon. It was a time of trade, and the merchant was the hero, whoever could amass the most money. In the age of Aries, the hero became the champion. Sometimes armies wouldn't fight. It would be one person fighting another person, one-on-one, and both sides would agree that whoever won of those two people, so that's the whole quality of the champion. If we look in the age of Pisces, who are the heroes? In the first place, the priests, every time that the equinox is proceeding through a negative polarity sign, the priesthood is stronger, and every time it goes through a positive polarity sign, the philosophers or the scientists are stronger. But what happened in this period, in the age of Pisces? All of the ocean explorers, all, you know, like Vasco da Gama and such, Christopher Columbus and all of that, they were the heroes. Now that we're approaching the age of Aquarius, who are the heroes now? The astronauts and the scientists and the revolutionaries, all of whom are Aquarian in nature. So these are the kinds of things that you can familiarize yourself with the zodiac and with the tone of the times and understanding history at the same time. And it's all that I have. Now, next time, from now on in, the talks get shorter. It'll be rare that one even runs for 75 minutes. Now, week by week, we're going to go through each of the planets. Only the emphasis with the planets is going to be different than the emphasis has been with the signs, because the planets are more definite things, and you can say more definite things, and you can look at them in ways that you couldn't when you looked at the signs. And then toward the end, we will look at the aspects, and then you will be familiar with all of the very basic elements of astrology. And then for the last time, getting together all together, we will look at the different horoscopes of everybody in the class that wants to be made fun of. I mean, that wants to know about themselves. That's it. It'll vary. Some years it'll be once a week, and some years it'll be every other week. It's usually good to start out with once a week. But everybody participates, too, if they want. People would be writing a lot of sentences and things. In fact, there might even be textbooks. I've had a textbook done since the last time I did the class, which was a few years ago, and I've never published it. And I've got one more to go, and then I can send them in for a copyright, and then I'll put them on the net for free for whoever wants one. Any other questions? Comments? Tomatoes? Whatever. Humanists and revolutionaries. Yes, yes. Because revolutionaries believe in the equality of everyone, especially if they determine when the revolution begins. The chief law on campus is we